possibility of military action, most likely against a naval target, and in particular against the Karish gas rig located offshore occupied Palestine in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. It is possible that in the absence of an agreement in the coming 10 days that would regulate the maritime borders between occupied Palestine and Lebanon, Hezbollah most probably will initiate the fight against the Israeli occupation, but in a new way. The Israeli occupation forces have already thickened their presence around the Karish gas rig. However, Hezbollah is the most serious fundamental threat to Israeli theft, occupation, and aggression in all of West Asia. Its military power is significantly stronger than any other resistance group Israel has faced so far, and even other armies in the region. The Israeli entity's scenario, as per its own media, for a war against Hezbollah includes hundreds of dead soldiers and severe damage to buildings and infrastructure throughout Palestinian areas occupied by Israel. This is because of Hezbollah's ability to launch thousands of rockets in a short period over many days, with great precision and firepower. The Lebanese resistance possesses approximately 50,000 short-range rockets of up to 40 kilometers, not including mortar bombs, in addition to approximately 100,000 medium and long-range rockets, dozens of which are precise and accurate. Israel has calculated that approximately 1,500 rockets will be launched each day of fighting on average from the territory of Lebanon. In addition, Hezbollah is expected to use the Radwan unit, a special ground maneuver force whose mission is to penetrate territory occupied by Israel, liberate Palestinian land from illegal Israeli settlements, and disrupt supply lines or movement of Israeli occupation forces. Hezbollah also owns a fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles and explosive drones. On top of that, Hezbollah is expected to use advanced anti-tank and anti-ship missile launch systems. In words of a Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily last week, the task for the military formations of the Islamic Resistance is to break Israel in any future battle, as this is considered one of the first steps towards its elimination. In short, as a sitting duck, Israel awaits Hezbollah's winter fire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. It is set. In the absence of an agreement in the coming weeks that would regulate the maritime borders between Lebanon and the Zionist Israeli entity, Hezbollah will move towards what it already warned the Israeli entity against, a war to preserve Lebanon's rights in its natural resources. Israel is striving not to reach war because, as simply put by a prominent Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper, if Israel leads us to war, we will fight it vigorously. The field commander warned that any upcoming war will be devastating for the Zionist entity in every sense of the word, affirming that the destruction of the entity will be greater than it ever imagined. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Awad. Now, at the center of the resistance decision-making process in Lebanon, the trend was clear-cut. As one field commander, a jihadi leader in the resistance Hezbollah, told Al-Akhbar, he said Hezbollah has entered a new phase and the mission of the resistance has evolved and its features have changed. Can you translate that on the battlefield as the tension rises between Lebanon and Israel as we approach September and the maritime border dispute is yet to be resolved between both sides?
This is the new phase that the resistance and all of the axes have entered. As Sayyid Nasrallah announced when he raised his finger and said, just as the land is ours, so is the water and all what is beneath it. Just as the skies are also ours, after the resistance declared its position of air defense weapons. What the field commander and Hezbollah stated for Al-Akhbar is just a translation of the resistance and its axis completing its preparations and all elements of transition from a defense strategy to an attack strategy. We see this in different battlefields. It is reflected practically in Lebanon. As the Islamic resistance have begun setting dates for confrontations, it has also started setting its options and directions. The upper hand in this matter is clearly for Hezbollah when it declares that during September the maritime registration should take place as per the demands of the Lebanese government, or else there will be no gas and oil to be extracted, not only at the border with occupied Palestine, but rather throughout the entire eastern part of the Mediterranean. This means that the resistance will be the initiator of this upcoming confrontation and that the resistance's demands will be met without any deficiency. The enemy and its allies have no time for procrastination and maneuvering. If things head towards a military confrontation, then the resistance will be the one to decide 0 hour, the battlefield location and the mechanism to end this confrontation. There is no doubt that there will be a confrontation between Israel and the Islamic resistance Hezbollah in Lebanon. If not because of maritime disputes, then it will be ignited for the many other disputes. In my personal opinion, I believe this war will take place either within weeks or within the upcoming 3 months, tops. At that point, when it happens, it will be dubbed the War of Liberating Palestine from the river to the sea.
Well, that is one dream that every true Arab is looking forward to, Dr. Awad. But another shocking statement that this anonymous field commander of Hezbollah said was that the enemy should know that the war with Hezbollah this time means the destruction of the infrastructure of the Israeli entity, which will turn the settlers' lives into real hell, unquote. What difference does it make if that actually happens when Lebanon also gets hit by the Israeli entity and its already weakened infrastructure is all destroyed? I mean, what good can that bring with such statements, if you will?
The Zionist entity has always attempted to terrorize the Lebanese public by claiming that it possesses a massive destructive power, whether via war jets or via precision missiles, which are capable of causing grave damage. Hence, the threats made by Hezbollah field commander concerning the destruction of the Israeli entity's infrastructure is upping the ante in the face of the constant Zionist threats. This is a strategy aiming at challenging the enemy by openly saying that our destruction equals your destruction too. For instance, during this past weekend, a voice recording was leaked, most probably from within the circles of the resistance, calling the resistance fighters and the civilians alike who reside at bordering villages to occupied Palestine to be careful when they enter the liberated Palestinian villages in the Upper Galilee to protect property, cars and the security in those areas. This all means that he who decides upon 0 hour, which most probably be Hezbollah, will also control the course of the battle. When the battle begins and Hezbollah resistance fighters enter the Upper Galilee, Israel will not be able to maneuver, neither in geography nor in its ability to launch missile attacks, nor make use of its Iron Dome, nor its war jets that might not even find runways to land on when they return after the air raids. So this speech about destruction emphasized the increasing capabilities of the resistance, not only in precision missiles and armed drones, but also that its firepower is similar to that of the Israeli enemy, fully capable of causing major damage and destruction inside enemy lines. Mind you, this speech is very effective at the psychological level, knowing that the Zionist settlers are not the kind that remain steadfast during confrontations. On the contrary, they would rather flee than stay behind and fight for their entity. If this war will take place, it will do so within the heart of the Palestinian land.
Well, but there's one other thing that actually is a challenge for Hezbollah, and that is the internal political foes of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. In the event of a war between the Lebanese resistance and the Israeli entity, do you think that Hezbollah's back, meaning the internal Lebanese arena, will be actually safe for the resistance, or we will be seeing for the first time several fronts being utilized against the Lebanese resistance with the internal Lebanese land with it? With 1 minute, please.
In the event of a war, I believe that Hezbollah's back will be fully protected from within the Lebanese territory against all rumors. This time, the back of the resistance will be more protected than the last war in 2006. Because in 2006, the resistance faced a huge challenge internally, initiated by the cabinet and its prime minister at that time. We had back then ministers who not only covered for the massacres committed by the entity, but also provided the enemy with intel about resistance locations. This presented a grave danger to the resistance. However, today, whatever happens, even if a war breaks out, we know that the entire Lebanese regime stands behind the Lebanese resistance. Just 2 weeks ago, when the American envoy negotiating the maritime dispute, Amos Hochstein, he met with all three presidencies and they all stood behind the resistance. Which means that the actual Lebanese government, unlike what we were used to from former governments, actually stands in a different place, in support of the resistance. That was applicable due to Hezbollah's wisdom that kept reminding everyone that the resistance and its weapons stand in service of all of the Lebanese people to retain sovereignty and to help Lebanon out of its current crisis. In short, if one morning we woke up and suddenly saw the flags of Hezbollah and Palestine raised upon the illegal Zionist settlements, it will be a magnificent scene, not only in Lebanon, but all across the Arab and Islamic world.
Well, across the whole world, that is a dream and that we wish will come true and we believe will come true. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, for joining us. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the escalating targeting of the U.S. occupation bases in Syria. Well, since 2016, the U.S. occupation Al-Tanf base has been located at the intersection of the Syrian-Iraqi-Jordanian border, supposedly housing Maghawir al-Thawra faction, as it was the base that was established to fight Daesh. Coincidentally or not, the presence of Daesh is still concentrated in the nearby valleys of that specific base, a presence that is activated from time to time, perhaps to bring an international justification to extend the life of the American occupation of Syrian territory. However, these attacks have intensified and expanded hours after the American assault on Deir ez-Zor last week, putting these attacks at a pace of systematic escalation separate from any possible political development in Vienna. Targeting U.S. occupation in Syria intensifies in this following report. Washington is deliberately heating up the front against the auxiliary forces of the Syrian army after the bases of the former in Al-Tanf and Al-Umar were repeatedly bombed. However, the response of the Syrian Arab Army forces was also not late, as they targeted American occupation bases again amid expectations that these attacks would only escalate in the future. An escalation that appears aimed at doubling the pressure on the U.S. forces of occupation to push them to leave Syria in light of the Astana trio, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, agreeing on this end goal. Not a few hours had passed after U.S. occupation war jets attacked positions of auxiliary forces of the Syrian Arab Army in the Ayyash area in Deir ez-Zor, until these fighting groups responded by targeting the two bases of the international coalition in the Conico and Al-Umar oil fields in the eastern countryside of Deir ez-Zor, which hosts American, British, and French occupation soldiers. As a result, there were casualties among the coalition forces. The U.S. military announced that an American soldier was slightly wounded, while two others were being examined for minor injuries following missile attacks in Syria at their occupation bases. On the other hand, the American forces targeted again Syrian Arab Army points in the Hawija Saqr area near Deir ez-Zor and near the city of Al-Mayadin and Jabal al-Thurda, all knowingly Syrian Arab Army positions and not, as the U.S. claims to be, Iranian-backed forces. This development prompted the coalition to mobilize its forces and to request the Kurdish separatists' leadership to deploy fighters along the Euphrates River, separating its areas of U.S. control and those under the Syrian Arab Army's control in participation of attacks from the latter against the former. For its part, the U.S. Central Command acknowledged in a statement that its bases had been bombed, pointing out that several missiles fell within the vicinity of the mission support base in Conico.
A short time later, rockets landed near the mission support site in the Green Village, also known as Al-Umar Field. Perhaps what reinforces Washington's fears in this context is that the fighting groups that used to target the vicinity of American occupation bases with mortars and rockets without causing significant material damage to the bases themselves, this time deliberately dropped all the missiles on the two bases' headquarters with the aim of producing the greatest possible damage in them and emphasizing that the following targets will directly hit those sites in order to double the military pressure on the Americans. Perhaps the U.S. announcement of the state of alert reflects the influx of intelligence information about the possibility of a military escalation against the coalition occupation bases in both Syria and Iraq, in light of the Syrian, Russian, Turkish, Iranian consensus on the need for the Americans to leave Syria.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Halabi, political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. And I know that you are suffering from electricity outages and several other technical issues. So I thank you for being with us despite these technical difficulties in Syria because of the sanctions. Now, let's begin at the center of the resistance in Syria against the U.S. occupation and with the escalation of the targeting of the American Atenf base. We see that these attacks not only include Atenf, but also Al-Umar and Conoco field bases as well. And they came in the wake of the American aggression on Deir ez-Zor, targeting Syrian Arab Army forces, which Biden directly ordered himself. But in light of this boiling nuclear file in Vienna, how do you assess this escalation against U.S. occupation bases inside of Syria?
I believe that after years of the presence of U.S. occupation forces at the triangle border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, which is known as Al-Tanf base, I believe that stressing on the continuation of this occupation as per the Hoover School of Geopolitics is simply to prevent ties between Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Jordan too. Closing the borders at that specific triangle aims at hindering military, economic, and political ties between the countries of the region. Hence, this is a strategic goal for the United States of America. But can the U.S. challenge three countries by breaching their borders and hindering them from forging ties with one another against their will? I think that is impossible, simply because the aim of the U.S. is beyond that. It aims at disintegrating Syria and Iraq. For instance, in Iraq, the U.S. is currently working on creating a separatist entity of Sunni Iraqis similar to the separatist Kurds in Syria. In the end, will this plan work? I believe the opposite will happen. All of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the resistance factions in Syria and Iraq will increase their efforts to spoil the U.S. plans for the region. I personally believe that the U.S. will not remain inside Syria for more than 1 year. That will be possible due to the boiling security situation, not only in West Asia, but also between Russia and Ukraine, and due to the Chinese threat against U.S. hegemony in Taiwan. So there is a global wave against U.S. hegemony, and so regionally, it is obvious that the axis of resistance that has the upper hand in the fight against every form of occupation inside Syria and Iraq as well.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, I definitely hear what you're saying, but according to the official U.S. statement that was released after the attack on Deir ez-Zor, it says that seven infrastructure facilities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were targeted in Deir ez-Zor in order to, and I quote, protect American bases from additional attacks, unquote. By claiming to target these Iranian so-called groups, the U.S. dodges the biggest question of all. What are they doing occupying Syrian land to begin with? I mean, the international community is obviously on another planet, but how much longer do you think the U.S. can play this game when 80% of the country is liberated and back in the hands of the Syrian Arab army?
I believe that the U.S. is trying to tell both Iraq and Syria that the presence of its soldiers in Syria and the war it is waging on the peoples of these two countries aims to simply remove those so-called militias. While knowing that it is these resistance groups in Syria and Iraq are the ones who initially stood against Daesh and Nusra, who came to be with European and American funding and training, these resistance factions are the ones capable of fighting and winning over the Takfiri terrorists of Daesh and Nusra, and not the US occupation whatsoever. It was evident later on, after the global war on Syria began, that it is in fact the US that is supporting these Takfiri groups instead of fighting these terrorists. This is why the US feels compelled to destroy the factions that belongs to the axis of resistance that chose to challenge the American schemes on West Asia. These resistance factions are defending their countries, their lands, from Takfiri terrorism. The Iranian, Iraqi and Syrian people know very well that it is the axis of resistance that rid them from terrorism and not the Americans whatsoever.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, political commentator and researcher, for your contribution about talking about the intensified attacks against the U.S. occupation in Syria. And thank you. Please stay tuned, because the upcoming couple of weeks are going to be intense in West Asia, most probably between Israel and Lebanon. So stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The Western world claims to practice freedom of expression, while it is proved that this motto is just a lie. When it comes to Palestinians and the issue of resistance, freedom of expression is widely restricted. This is evidently seen today by the actions of Facebook and Instagram in violating the rights of Palestinians during the Gaza war. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. The website of Middle East Eye wrote, Facebook and Instagram's policies during Israeli regime attacks on Gaza last year harmed the fundamental human rights of Palestinians, according to a report commissioned by the platform's parent company, Meta. The study, which was carried out by Consultancy Business for Social Responsibility, BSR, was obtained by The Intercept ahead of its publication recently. In May 2021, Meta was widely accused of censorship and bias during Israeli regime's assault on Gaza, which killed 256 Palestinians, including 66 children. Meta's actions in May 2021 appear to have had an adverse human rights impact on the rights of Palestinian users to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, political participation, and non-discrimination, and therefore on the ability of Palestinians to share information and insights about their experiences as they occurred, the report said. Middle East Eye reported last year that concerns had been raised about deleted social media content and account suspensions in relation to Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, where an Israeli crackdown on protests against forcible evictions sparked escalation in violence. According to the report, Meta deleted Arabic content related to last year's violence at a much greater rate than Hebrew language posts. This was found among posts reviewed by both automated services and employees. BSR attributed the difference in treatment to a lack of expertise. It concluded that Meta lacked staff who understood other cultures, languages, and histories, despite having over 70,000 employees and $24 billion in cash reserves. Potentially violating Arabic content may not have been rooted to content reviewers who speak or understand the specific dialect of the content, the report stated. During the outbreak of violence, Palestinian and Arab social media users revived an old Arabic font in an attempt to beat Facebook's algorithm and express their support for Palestine. The BSR report fell short of accusing Meta of deliberate bias, pointing instead to unintentional bias leading to different human rights impacts on Palestinian and Arab-speaking users. It found that Meta's dangerous individuals and organizations policy referred to in the report as DOI, which prevents its users from praising or representing a number of groups, focused mainly on Muslim entities and therefore disproportionately impacted Palestinians. It said, Meta's DOI policy and the list are more likely to impact Palestinian and Arabic-speaking users, both based upon Meta's interpretation of legal obligations. Palestinians are more likely to violate Meta's DOI policy because of the presence of Hamas as a governing entity in Gaza and political candidates affiliated with designated organizations, the report said. The study concluded with 21 non-binding recommendations, which included increasing staff capacity to analyze Arabic posts and reforming the dangerous individuals and organizations policy. Meta vaguely committed to implementing 20 of the recommendations, according to Intercept. The company did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Its response to the report will be included when the document is published in full. In a footnote to the response seen by the Intercept, it said Meta's publication of this response should not be construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the war in Ukraine drags on, Russia announces its intent to intensify its military operation there. President Putin has now announced a partial mobilization of Russia's military forces. Putin said the defense ministry had recommended drawing military reservists into active service as the country faces a protracted conflict in Ukraine and Donbas. Putin says the measure is necessary because Russia is fighting, quote, the entire Western military machine in Ukraine. Putin further accused Ukraine of backing away from a deal that was in the making to end the war. After certain compromises were reached, Kiev received a de facto direct order to derail all agreements. More weapons were pumped into Ukraine. The Kiev regime deployed more gangs of international mercenaries and nationalists, military units trained to NATO standards, and under de facto command of Western advisers. Putin is referring to negotiations that gained momentum following the start of the war back in February. But the West, headed by the United States, pressured Kiev to quit the talks. The West saw the war as an opportunity to contain Russia. In other words, the United States and its allies capitalized on Moscow's moves in Ukraine to settle their long-running differences with the Kremlin. They then began pouring military hardware into East Europe and Ukraine in particular. The United States has already given billions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and encouraged the leaders in Ukraine to keep up the fight at the expense of their own people. Ukraine has now turned into a battleground used by the United States and its allies in their fight against Russia. During his Wednesday speech, President Putin also commented on the upcoming referendums in the two Donbas republics and two regions of Ukraine currently controlled to a large extent by Russian troops. They are putting to a general vote a proposal to ask Moscow to accept them as new parts of the Russian Federation. The polling is scheduled for Friday. Back in February, Russia recognized the two Donbas regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as sovereign republics. However, Kiev lost de facto control of both in 2014 when the local populations rejected the outcome of the Western-backed Maidan coup. But it now appears that they are set to join Russia, which will further increase tensions. It's believed that Russia's partial mobilization is to prepare for the possible fallout of that decision. Back in 2014, Russia took control of the strategic Crimea Peninsula following a referendum there. Ukraine, backed by the West, has made some inroads into the territories held by Russia. Ukraine's counter-offensive has seen the country recapture the first village in Luhansk. They are also making inroads into the Kharkiv region. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has claimed that the Russian invaders are now in, quote, panic. But Russia has not given any indication that it's prepared to accept Kiev's demands for a full withdrawal from Ukrainian territory, including areas seized in 2014. It now appears that the confrontation between Russia and the West, which practically started since the fall of the Berlin Wall, has entered a new phase. And there are now concerns that the crisis may develop into a nuclear war between the global powers.
World leaders gathered in New York to attend the UN General Assembly. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was among the leaders to have attended the international event.
During a speech, President Raisi hailed Iran's, quote, prominent and progressive role in confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, especially terrorism that is instigated and supported by the U.S. Raisi noted that thanks to General Soleimani's commandership, Iran emerged to thwart the plots that were aimed at manipulating the geopolitics of the West Asia region.
The fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved General Qasem Soleimani.
Raisi also said that Iran will follow up the prosecution of the former American president Donald Trump through a just court. The assassination of General Soleimani was directly ordered by Trump and occurred near Baghdad Airport on January 3, 2020. Raisi also hailed the emergence of a new world order that's in the making. The crisis has reshaped geopolitics of not only Europe, but also the West and East Asia regions. The Ukraine war and the crises that followed have created new alliances and enmities. The U.S.-led bloc is locked in an all-out confrontation with Russia, And in order to avoid Western pressure, Russia has launched its policy to look for allies in the East. Moscow is now getting closer to Beijing and Tehran. And new alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS grouping of countries are getting more powerful. The emerging New World Order is giving more weight to multilateralism as the key to overcome the ongoing challenges. The unilateralism of the U.S. is seen as the key obstacle to a more just world order. The fate of many countries, especially countries in the West Asia region, shows that the U.S. is pursuing its own interests against the interests of its allies. Iran is among the countries that has pursued an independent policy since its inception.
Some may have the perception that our ties with Eastern countries such as Russia and China, saying that there are more closer ties with those countries, that is, prior to this administration, there was the perception that the government just focused on merely a number of countries in the West. But if I want to speak about my administration's perspective, it's a balanced one, having a view towards all countries. Any country that wants to cooperate with the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have our policy of interaction and cooperation with all countries with priority given to neighboring states.
And that has drawn anger and frustration on the part of the U.S. and its Western and regional countries. During the U.N. General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden criticized Russia for its war on Ukraine.
Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter, no more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force.
But it's high time to remind Washington regime of its long history of wars and interventions all over the world, especially the West Asia region.
And in terms of the veto, the U.S. president said that veto-wielding members should refrain from excessive use of their veto power. This is while the U.S. has deployed its veto power dozens of times to protect Israel.
The U.S. must also be held accountable for its use of double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. When it comes to Iran and the UN General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen.
I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ebrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ebrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example, he kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions. showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time. This is what the UN Charter, Article 2, states. All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means, in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. A comparative look between Iran versus the U.S. makes it glaringly clear that the U.S. is acting in the opposite direction of this charter. It has indeed taken a militaristic approach when it comes to making a choice between war and peace. It is worth noting that to this day, Iran has not invaded any country or indeed started a war in more than two centuries, something that the U.S. cannot claim. As a matter of fact, recently Iran may have set a new record for hosting foreign dignitaries. In a matter of 1 week, not a day went by when a high-ranking official was not in Iran, which included figures like the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the likes. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be making his presence coming up fresh from his appearance at the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This is important, since Iran has become a permanent member of this organization. And the reason for this importance is, unlike claims made by the U.S. and the West, Iran is an important fixture on the world stage.
In recent years, political and economic multilateralism has come under serious threat. The U.S. government is trying to impose its demands and domestic law on the international system and sovereign countries through outright bullying and coercion. Washington's unilateralism is undoubtedly aimed at hampering independent countries' progress.
The SCO is the world's largest regional organization, covering approximately 60% of the area of Eurasia, 40% of the world population, and more than 30% of the global GDP. Yet a recent incident took place that did not get much coverage, but it displayed how the Islamic Republic has peaceful intentions when it comes to conflicts and can act as a mediator. It had to do with the Ukraine conflict. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amri Abdollahian, delivered a European peace initiative on Ukraine to Russia, in which Iran said it had received the proposal from an anonymous European leader. This squarely pits Iran's peaceful intentions against the U.S. warmongering policy when it comes to Ukraine. So, when Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi takes the podium, representing Iran and his peaceful intentions, like its peaceful nuclear program, it is showing how Iran deserves the respect that it is entitled to, not the sanctions and embargoes imposed by the West and the U.S. Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
Bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline, criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists, like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today, we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change.
We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations like Exxon knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. They were accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when in essence they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite promising to reform Trump-era immigration policies, U.S. President Joe Biden has yet to take immediate action. On his first day in office, and in a publicity stunt, he merely canceled Trump's so-called immigration order, and yet he didn't solve migrants' problems. Human rights groups, while expressing deep concern about the recent illegal transfer of migrants by some Republican governors under false promises and also mass deportation of immigrants by government officials, described their action as a violation of international law. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Stay tuned, please. The Guardian Daily wrote, the U.S. Democratic lawmakers have called on the Justice Department to investigate whether Florida and Texas officials broke any federal law when they moved dozens of asylum seekers from Texas to Martha's Vineyard under false pretenses. The letter from the congressional representatives, Jerry Connolly, Sylvia Garcia, Ted Lieu, and dozens of other Democrats, followed the emergence of a report in which a 27-year-old migrant said he was paid $200 by a mystery figure known as Perla to find people outside the San Antonio Migrant Center to board a flight. The migrant, who was called Emmanuel, told the San Antonio report that he gave Perla contact information for 10 other migrants. The letter said as the federal government retains jurisdiction over cases that involve interstate travel, we request the Department of Justice investigate whether any federal funds were used to operate a fraudulent scheme and request the Department of Justice make a determination as to whether officials in Texas and Florida violated federal law. At least one criminal investigation has already been opened into the situation by a Texas sheriff, and Connolly and others said the Justice Department should do the same. Multiple media reports have depicted how the asylum seekers had been misled once they arrived in Texas and were incorrectly told they were being flown to Boston. The letter said it is charged that immigration officials knowingly falsified mailing addresses for the migrants by selecting arbitrary homeless shelters across the United States with the expectation that migrants would be required to contact the wrong agency. Details have not yet emerged about the planning and execution of the plan, which was spearheaded by the office of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. NBC News explains more about this story, saying the transportation service company that the Florida governor Ron DeSantis used to arrange flights for migrants to Martha Vineyard has contributed money to governor's top allies and has connections to a Florida official in charge of its immigration policy. Virtual Systems Incorporation, an Oregon-based aviation company that DeSantis used to fly asylum seekers to the liberal-leaning Massachusetts island, has connections to DeSantis' political allies and has donated money to various campaigns. The company once had legal representation from the Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who was previously part of DeSantis' transition team when he became governor, and Gaetz' former law partner Larry Keefe, who now works as the state's public safety czar and carries out the controversial relocation program. Florida State Representative Jay Trumbull Jr., a Republican involved in obtaining funding for the relocation program as Appropriations Committee Chair, received a $1,000 donation from Virtual during his campaign for Florida State Senate this year. The company also donated over $12,000 in total to various Florida political campaigns, including $2,500 to a super PAC that supported Gaetz. DeSantis' administration has continually refused to release information on money it has given Virtual for its role in relocating asylum seekers. So far, the company was awarded $12 million contract and has received more than $1 million from Florida to fly asylum seekers to Democrat-led northern cities, including migrants who are located in other states. Public records have confirmed that Florida paid Virtual $615,000 recently to recruit about 50 migrants in Texas and fly them to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, with authorities noting that many resources like cash assistance and job training when no arrangement had been made with the island. The Intercept website elaborates more about the issue, saying the charactered flights are currently the subject of a criminal investigation in Texas, as well as a civil suit from the asylum seekers themselves, who say they were deceived into going. The Virtual company was also been expected to fly another group of asylum seekers on Tuesday, September 20th, to an airport located near Joe Biden's beach house in Delaware, but the charter flight never arrived, though Florida gave Virtual an additional $950,000. As a result, 20 migrants who were hoping to travel to the state were left stranded in San Antonio, with a source familiar with the governor saying the governor purposely left people in the dark about the flight's plans. DeSantis' administration has not released details of the contract it awarded to Virtual or disclosed why Virtual was selected to conduct a relocation program or answered inquiries as to whether multiple bids were solicited in regards to the program, as is required by law. While DeSantis has defended the program, his administration has faced intense criticism that they did not have budget authority to fly asylum seekers, and Florida lawmakers have questioned whether the flights were legal. Lawyers representing the migrants have also argued that their clients are not unauthorized aliens, but are asylum seekers, which is a distinct legal category.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we looked into the adverse effects and potential dangers of psychotropic drugs. We went to France, the number one user of such medication, to see how psychotropic drugs prescribed much too readily and in a cocktail to cure feelings of anxiety and depression have in some cases led to madness, suicide, extreme acts of violence, and murder. Yet the root cause of the extensive use of such drugs seems to be much more than naive and